You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
So welcome back to the podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this episode, we're going to explore safe sedation by critical care paramedics with Tim Edwards. So in the conversation, we're going to look at the research examining methods of safe sedation by advanced paramedic practitioners within London, and also examine the research published on this, looking at sedation of acute behavioural disturbance, so ABD, within the domain. So we're going to examine what the retrospective cohort study of pre-hospital agitation management showed. And we're also going to look at the sedation of ABD patients and some of the challenges and risks that come with that. So we're also going to look at the origins of ABD according to the paper. We're going to look at the sedation assessment tool, the SAT tool, used to measure pre- and post-intervention. And then we're going to look at some of the approaches that APPs or advanced paramedic practitioners can take to sedate patients. So to do this, I have Tim Edwards with me. Tim is a consultant paramedic with the London Ambulance Service NHS Trust. He's also a visiting lecturer at Harvard University. Tim's been a paramedic since the year 2000 and also has undertaken various roles, including working as a flight paramedic, a senior lecturer, and an advanced paramedic practitioner, and is currently working as a consultant within London. Welcome to the podcast, Tim.
Hello.
Tim, I thought we could just start by getting you to speak to this patient group, so that of acute behavioural disturbance. Could you maybe just speak to some of the general challenges that this patient group posed to clinicians?
Yeah, so I think it's important to consider that acute behavioural disturbance is probably at the extreme end of the range of altered behaviour that we might see as paramedics. So I think one of the big challenges to start with acute behavioural disturbance is often that there are friends and family present and there are other agencies, often the police and potentially door staff or security staff. And also that very often those patients will be subject to a degree of physical restraint, and that obviously poses risks as well. And then there are risks to paramedics with those patients who may be very dissociated. There's a risk potentially of physical injury, and often there are competing priorities. So law enforcement agencies may have different priorities to family members who may have different priorities to paramedics. And so navigating your way through that is very challenging from an ambulance service or EMS perspective.
So just looking at the paper and looking at the origins of ABD within the paper, it denotes that drugs and alcohol are really the main origins, or the most commonly seen. Could you maybe speak to why this is such a significant challenge?
I think it's very difficult to tell whether the behaviour that you're seeing represents true ABD as per some of the accepted definitions, versus somebody who's experiencing the effects of alcohol at the extreme end of the spectrum, or the effects of drugs at the extreme end of the spectrum, or the combination of the two. And that feeds into decisions about where those patients should go, because sometimes, again, law enforcement will be keen that those patients go into custody, particularly if there's been an assault or an allegation of a crime being committed. Family members may be keen to avoid both custody and hospital, may wish to try and manage the patient at home. So there's a lot of, as I said before, competing and conflicting priorities in caring for those patients.
So maybe could we just speak to and look at the sedation assessment tool used by paramedics? I think it's probably akin to the RAS score, or it's quite an appropriate analog to the RAS score. Could you maybe speak to the safety sedation assessment tool?
Yeah, so it's a fairly straightforward scale. It's based on a combination of responsiveness and or speech or verbal behaviours. So essentially, it allows us to qualify someone's behaviour in an objective way. So if we start at the extreme end, a SAT score of +3 indicates a patient who's combative, violent, or might be described as out of control. They might have continual loud outbursts of speech, and often they won't be making sense with that. And then if you scroll all the way down to a -3, that's a patient who's non-responsive and not speaking. And that would be the lowest level that you would get to after administration of sedation. And so the patient in the middle who's at a 0 is generally described as awake, calm, and cooperative, speaking normally. So hopefully how we are on the podcast.
So just looking at the study in detail, so 237 patients over a certain period of time. So 62% of these were physically restrained, but only 44% of these 237 patients were chemically restrained. Could you maybe speak to sort of what this indicates and reflects regarding the use and efficacy of other sort of de-escalation techniques, maybe more simple de-escalation techniques?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the important thing is that obviously those techniques are within the scope of practice and capabilities of all paramedics, or not just paramedics, but all EMS responders. And they're really important techniques. So I think there's some patients for whom just a period of watchful waiting means that their behavior calms and they don't need any intervention. And sometimes you might see that in patients who are post-ictal, for example, as you know. And actually, sometimes you might attend the scene as a specialist practitioner and find that a patient has calmed, and actually the initial request for assistance was perfectly reasonable, but just by watchful waiting, the behaviour has changed to a point where sedation isn't required. There's only a group of patients who are being subject to physical restraint, and very often, particularly in a law enforcement setting, there may have been a struggle. There may have been a struggle to get the patient under control. There may have been a physical altercation. And actually, once that has calmed, if you can reduce a bit of restraint, if you can calm the scene, the patient's behavior will de-escalate to a level where chemical sedation isn't required. And then there's a set of patients for whom sedation probably is the safest and appropriate method of managing them. But as you can see from the study results, certainly in our system, that's by no means all the patients that we would see who are labelled as ABD.
Just looking at the pharmacological agents used by advanced paramedics, could you maybe speak to, so before we sort of look at the agents themselves, could you speak to the governance structure in place, so the PGDs, the case review, that monitor and review these tools?
Yes, I think it's important for people from an international perspective to understand what a PGD is as well. So in UK paramedic practice, a registered paramedic has a range of medicines that they may possess and administer on a list, the Human Medicines Regulations. Any drugs that we want to use that are not on that list either require the paramedic to train as an independent prescriber, which, as you will know, can happen in UK practice and does happen, or it requires the paramedic to be authorised under a PGD, a patient group direction, and that's essentially a written protocol for the supply or administration of a drug, and you can't deviate from that. And that's the legal basis on which paramedics in this study were giving the medicines at that time. So when we conducted the study, we had midazolam and haloperidol as an antipsychotic agent available. We've since introduced ketamine, but that wasn't available during the retrospective study period. So at the time of the study, haloperidol and midazolam only, and now both of those agents with the addition of ketamine. And what tends to happen now is that the individual practitioner will make a decision about what the most appropriate drug or drugs is in the situation that they're presented with. So you might see a patient who appears to be acutely psychotic, and you might decide that initially haloperidol only is appropriate because of the circumstances. At the other end of the spectrum, you may see a patient who's being actively restrained is the typical ABD case, for whom rapid tranquilization is the goal, and therefore you'd probably start with intramuscular ketamine.
So looking at the risks involved with sedation, so the paper actually outlines some of the risks involved in sedation. And having very much been a critical care practitioner yourself for a number of years, could you maybe speak to the importance of having resuscitation equipment to hand, and indeed also briefing the team as to the risks involved?
Yes, so I think there's variation internationally in practice, and in the UK we've traditionally been very wary of sedation and conscious sedation. So benzodiazepines, for example, are only used by UK paramedics predominantly for management of seizures and some limited indications around cocaine toxicity, but sedation is not a standard skill for a UK paramedic. I think the first thing to say about ABD patients is that circulatory collapse is a real risk and a sudden deterioration is a real risk. And sometimes people can interpret a patient becoming less responsive or quieter as an improvement in their condition, whereas actually that may be a pre-terminal sign. It indicates complete physiological exhaustion. So whenever you're treating an ABD patient, whether you're sedating them or not, you need to be aware that circulatory collapse can be a complication. I think you need to pay meticulous attention to basic airway management. So it's not unusual for a patient to need some basic airway management maneuvers if they undergo rapid tranquilization. We tend to use ketamine for that reason because it's fairly safe as an agent in terms of airway management, but no sedation agent is 100% safe. Then there's the potential risks of aspiration. And so the requirement to have basic airway adjuncts, advanced airway adjuncts, and a means of suction is really, really important, and a means of ventilating the patient, obviously, if they need it. So that's a rare complication in our system, but it does happen occasionally. And then, of course, as we said, circulatory collapse is a real possibility in a small subset of these patients. And so having equipment for resuscitation available is also really, really important. And assigning, as far as you can, specific team roles before you start that process is important as well. So an airway paramedic, paramedic or other clinician to put monitoring on, those kinds of things, so that once you make the decision to give the drug, you can look after the patient promptly once sedation takes effect.
Absolutely, to that point, Tim. And I always used to be quite militant actually about using entitled CO2 monitoring as well as oxygen saturations, because you can start to see trending upwards or downwards, and that respiratory rate is key, but also the just to getting as much feedback as possible in the space. Could you maybe speak to, so the paper speaks to sort of the two largest categories of acute behavioral disturbance, being that of drugs and alcohol and mental health. Could you, like you said before, there's a lot of nuances with dealing with these two presentations, because especially with mental health resides, it can be concomitant. So there can be either an absence of medication, which has brought forward a mental health condition, or a concomitant use of drugs within a mental health presentation, or both of which make it hard sometimes to discriminate. Could you maybe speak to the sort of these two main contributors denoted in the paper?
Yeah, so what we were asking to paramedics to do was to record the clinical impression that they thought most likely fitted with the patient at that time. So if they thought drugs and alcohol were the predominant reason for the behavior, they would have listed that first, and vice versa for mental health. But you are right, as we said, it's really difficult to distinguish between the two very often. You might find that a small amount of a recreational drug will actually produce very profound psychiatric symptoms. And actually, the fact that you've effectively activated a psychiatric condition with a small amount of a recreational drug may mean that predominantly the acute behavioral disturbance is linked to psychiatric issues and not to the drug itself. Conversely, you may have a mental health history, but actually you've taken a sufficient quantity of drugs and or alcohol to mean that that's the predominant reason for your behavior. But as you say, often very difficult to distinguish between the two.
So the paper denotes actually around the presence of the police, as you said before, quite a frequent attenders, if not always in attendance to cases of ABD. And you can understand why from a physical restraint perspective. Could you maybe speak to how important it is to sort of collaborate and work with police colleagues to sort of share the mental model, share the plan, and indeed share the prospective sort of chemical sedation that you were just about to undertake?
Yeah, so I mean, it's absolutely essential. So the first thing is that, as we said before, there may be an allegation that a crime's been committed. The police may have been subject to physical violence. There's often been a requirement for restraint. And we need to distinguish between someone who the police may regard as a prisoner and the person that we may regard as a patient. And very often, winning the police over to thinking of them more as a patient with an acute medical emergency is the starting point for that. And also, there's been a lot more awareness work with police officers now. So ABD, certainly in London, is a much better understood concept. And there's a more of a shared understanding between police and ambulance services about ABD. So very often what we will do is to identify who the lead police officer is, the person who's most likely to be able to influence the behaviour of the other officers at the scene. We'll engage with them and we'll take steps to help them understand the risks associated with this and the fact that ABD is a medical emergency and that patients are at risk with death if they are mismanaged or not treated appropriately. And then depending on the situation, there needs to be a judgment call about whether you're going to promote release of restraint to some degree to see whether that will help with normalizing behavior. But that's very much a judgment call. And there's often a reluctance around police officers who've struggled to get control of somebody to then subsequently do that in case they lose control again. So these situations are context specific and often very challenging.
Just looking at the paper itself, how does this sort of the safe sedation, as reflected from this paper, improve upon the risks involved with physical restraint? There has been a lot in this space around physical restraints, and I think that, as you said before, the police are acutely aware of physical restraint and the danger of putting pressure on the chest and indeed of turning patients and or assailants onto their chests, so it impairs respiratory rate. Could you maybe just speak to how this paper sort of reflects well around the concept of safe sedation?
Yeah, so I think there's a number of things. I think that the obvious thing, as you say, is that an appropriate level of sedation can reduce or eliminate the requirement for physical restraint. And we know that prolonged physical restraint is bad for patients. So at the extreme end of the spectrum, the patients that are positioned prone with somebody kneeling on their back with their arms handcuffed or held behind their back is at risk of obstruction to breathing and asphyxia. And unfortunately, we've seen that in cases globally, including in the UK, or the use of less safe restraints. So grabbing somebody around the neck, those kinds of things. And police officers are well trained in that now, and very often they will have moved them, if they can, into a slightly better position, perhaps on their side, for example, rather, but certainly not prone on the floor, which we know is probably the most dangerous positioning. So sedation can allow physical restraint to reduce, which is often safer. And obviously what we're aiming for with some patients is conscious sedation, where they can be roused, and with other patients, we're aiming for true rapid tranquilization. The other thing that it facilitates, obviously, as well as reducing or eliminating restraint, is treatment. So very often those patients may have injuries. They may also, in some cases, require active cooling. So if they've taken a drug that's made them hypothermic, as you know, application of active cooling in those patients can be genuinely life-saving, and the earlier that's carried out, the better it is. So it reduces the requirement for physical restraint and allows treatment of any injuries or other medical conditions to commence at the same time.
So as we come into land on the conversation, Tim, just a couple more questions. One would be around if you could speak to some of the institutional strategies to advocate for the de-escalation of these patients, because as the paper reflects, you know, over half the cohort didn't actually need chemical restraints. And as you also said, verbal de-escalation and or some of these softer skills are a generic paramedic skill. They're a skill that any paramedic can institute. Could you maybe speak to some of the wider educational and or institutional strategies to advocate for these techniques?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's important to say that we're talking about a group of advanced paramedics who are generally very experienced, highly educated, regularly exposed to these patients. And that's an important part of the system. And they're also very tightly governed. So they have regular access to morbidity and mortality meetings. There are clinical performance indicators in place to monitor their clinical treatment and regular training. Minimum entry requirements for paramedics looking to become advanced practitioners, certainly for critical care, but also for colleagues in urgent care, are that they need to be BSc graduate paramedics with a minimum of 5 years post-registration experience. But actually, to be honest, certainly in the first few cohorts, as you will know, there were very few people with less than 10 years experience. And so we want them to be decision makers and intelligent decision makers first and foremost, rather than operating to a protocol. So I think where we watch practice globally, I think we've seen some of the shortfalls of having a very protocol driven approach that says, if X happens, you must do Y. What we see with this paper is that with a group of educated, experienced practitioners, you will see a patient specific decision made that might be different on each occasion, tailored to their needs. And I think that's a really important part of what we do.
Finally, as we come into land, Tim, I firmly agree with that point, actually. And I think that meld of experience and education can breed a lot of successful outcomes, actually, and a lot of de-escalation in that space. Could you maybe speak to, as we come into land, what next is in this space from a research perspective? Is there any ongoing work with, as you said now, ketamine has been instituted for sedation? And indeed, the use of sedation assessment tools, is there anything on the horizon?
Well, we're still monitoring ketamine. And I think probably what we need to do is repeat the research now that we've integrated ketamine. And that's probably something for the future. I think one of the other things that we're interested in is how to ensure that we're consistently able to deliver active cooling to the small group of patients that need that. And one of the challenges with that has been that in the era of mild therapeutic hypothermia, when we thought that that might become a standard post-ROSC treatment, there were lots of companies very interested in producing portable cooling equipment for use by EMS or use in the pre-hospital phase. And since mild therapeutic hypothermia has fallen out of fashion in favor of fever prevention rather, you know, so maintenance of normothermia rather than induction of mild hypothermia, the availability of those devices has waned. Now, we know that the most appropriate or the fastest method, should we say, of cooling somebody is to put them in an ice bath, but clearly that's not appropriate for us. Very often in London, we can get supplies of frozen vegetables or ice from 24-hour shops that might be open, but we'd like something I think that's a bit more consistent and controlled than having to improvise each time we see those patients. So that those are probably a couple of areas of focus for the future.
Tim, listen, thank you. It's been fantastic getting your thoughts. I think we'll put the paper in the show notes for people to read and refer to. But thank you once again for your insights.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.